Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Alec Griffin, and he'll be answering your most important questions on big red fish in the Louisiana bayous. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Alec a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address there on the left-hand side of our homepage. Submit that, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you do have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Escobar Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Alec Griffin about fly fishing for big redfish in the Louisiana bayous. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is only one of a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, still water fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Alec, we'd like to let you know about some of the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we're going to be giving away a 3-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. We have 2 chances to win in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, go to our homepage, and under Alec's section there, you'll find a link that says, click here to register for our drawing. I'll just click on that link, fill out that form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a dozen of Alec Griffin's favorite redfish flies. And I hear from Alec that they're guaranteed to catch nothing but 10-pound reds. Now, I think that's what I remember he told me, but we'll check on that in just a minute. Now, here's how you can win those. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question's going to be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using that text box on our homepage. Same place that you can ask questions during the show is the place that you'll submit your answer to that question at the end of the show. Our guest tonight is Alec Griffin. He is a manager of Uptown Angler in New Orleans, has been fly fishing for the past 15 years and working in the fly fishing industry for the last 10. As a North Carolina native, Alec found his way to Jackson Hole, Wyoming after graduating from Appalachian State to spend a few months fishing in the great western rivers he'd only heard stories about. A few months turned into a few years, and after spending time working for a couple of different fly shops and outfitters, Alec decided to head down south and pursue a career using his advertising degree. Luckily, he found a fly shop, Uptown Angler, before he began work at the advertising agency and managed to pick up a part-time job there. He soon took over the manager position at Uptown Angler and started on his quest to help share the fly fishing treasure he'd found with the rest of the world. Having had the opportunity to get out on the flats and chase Louisiana redfish around the marsh his second day in New Orleans, Alec was hooked on those shallow water predators and was amazed at their ferocity when attacking a fly, sometimes occurring within just feet from the bow of the flat skiff. That was 7 years ago, and Alec's enthusiasm and passion for chasing Louisiana redfish on the fly and helping to grow the sport in New Orleans has anything but wavered. Alec is spending more and more time on the water these days and has more than a few great stories to tell about big, the bad, but the never-ugly Louisiana redfish. Well, Alec, thanks for joining us tonight, and welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, good, good. Well, I heard you had a good day out on the water today.
We had a wonderful day out today. It's probably the best weather day, potentially, that we've had all fall. The winds worked in our favor. The sun worked in our favor. Water levels were great. and the redfish were eating. So we just had a fantastic day out there today. Classic fall redfish day in Louisiana.
Great, great. All you need is a cold beer, and you've done the day, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, let's dig in here. We're going to try to focus on redfish tonight, folks, in Louisiana specifically. We did do another show in the past on redfish, and you can search our archives on that show to get a bit more background. But that kind of was all-encompassing and covered a lot of territory, and tonight we're focusing just on Louisiana and its bayous and rivers and so forth down there. So just to fill people in quickly, Alec, tell us what a redfish is and what it looks like in Louisiana.
Well, redfish, it's a fantastic game fish, definitely the most sought-after shallow-water game fish here in Louisiana. It's a red drum. People may also be familiar with black drum. This is a red drum. You know, sometimes they're referred to as a variety of things other than redfish or red drum. I've heard them referred to as spot-tail, channel bass, where I grew up in North Carolina, at least on the coast of North Carolina. Always heard them referred to as puppy drum. Down here in Louisiana, you'll even hear occasionally those fish referred to by the French name Poisson Rouge. So they're referred to by quite a few names, but we call them redfish most of the time, but it is a drum.
And can you kind of describe what it looks like?
Absolutely. It's a pretty meaty fish. The best way I can describe it is it's a fish that looks like it has shoulders. Typically, you know, a nice bronze or copper color to those fish, although sometimes they can appear to be a little bit more silvery or gray. It really depends on where that fish lives. But most of the time, especially the fish that we're catching, you know, in the interior marsh, definitely have that copper bronze tone to it with a white or just light cream color underbottom and usually a very pronounced black spot just in front of the tail fin. Sometimes even multiple spots, but definitely that is something that differentiates the redfish, you know, from some of those other fish, such as the black drum. When you see it in the waters, even from a distance, when you see those fish in the water, you can see that black spot at times. So very pronounced black spot, kind of a signature spot there on the tail that a lot of people think of when they think of redfish.
That's one you see in the pictures all the time, right?
Absolutely.
That's,
You bet.
Distinctive. Yeah. Can you kind of discuss behavior of the redfish throughout the year down in your area? I know this differs in different parts of the country, but kind of what's their life cycle and how do they act and react throughout the year down there?
Well, you know, first I would say as far as behavior goes, and this is one thing that I love about the redfish, is that there's almost nothing you can expect from a redfish. They are as moody as fish come. I would not generalize them as being a spooky fish. In fact, more often than not, I would say the exact opposite. You can catch these fish so close to the boat and literally put flies directly in front of their face and a lot of those times not have that fish spook. So I wouldn't classify it as a spooky fish. But, you know, Roger, you could have, you know, great conditions one day and, you know, be able to do no wrong, have a redfish eat every fly you put anywhere close to it. The next day you could have the same conditions and those redfish, you know, be spooky as any bonefish and seem to have a lockjaw. So I think that's one thing that makes the redfish so fun. It's really a character in that it's just completely unpredictable. But they are, I would say, by nature, aggressive fish. Typically, you know, are great fish in terms of just their ferociousness to eat anything that happens to come in front of it. When you do catch them on those good days and when they're feeding well, the strikes are just vicious. So it's a lot of fun to watch these fish eat. There's nothing subtle typically about a redfish take. You know, sometimes you'll even find those fish, you know, moving in twos and threes, and I really at times just refer to those or think of those fish as war parties because it seems like when you have a few fish swimming together that they really get competitive over flies at times when you throw in front of them. So they're very opportunistic, very aggressive feeders. But once again, they're moody, and one day they might completely turn off and seem to have lockjaw for no real apparent reason. And, you know, I always say I guess that's what keeps us honest, because the days that the bite is on strong, the days that make heroes out of any fisherman out there, these fish will just do some crazy things that if you only came and fished on that day in Louisiana and left, you would assume that fishing here was easy. But it's not, because it changes daily. They're very moody fish. You know, in terms of their behavior, you know, through different ages, the only statement I can make about that is that most of the time, the bull red fish, you know, that we see in the marsh quite often, well, at this time of year, for example, late fall on into the winter, they tend to be a little spookier. They require the angler to be a little bit more on their A game to effectively catch those fish. So, you know, I guess you could say as they get older, they seem to get wiser. You know, some of those younger, you know, resident juvenile redfish tend to be, you know, a little more aggressive at times and maybe a little more readily take a fly that wasn't necessarily delivered perfectly, whereas those bull reds really require you most of the time to once again be on your A game, put that fly in that one little zone. So I would say as they get older, at least those bull reds anyways, when they come back into the marsh, can definitely be a little more wary, a little more, if you want to call them educated. I guess they got big for a reason. But other than that, you know, I would say any of those juvenile redfish, those resident redfish that you find in the marsh, whether you're talking about a 4-pound fish or an 8 or 9 or even 10-pound fish, you catch them on the right day, and they're all just going to be aggressive as all get out. And the next day, they could all have lockjaw, so to speak.
Okay. Well, what's their life cycle through the marshes? Are they, do they live there all year round, or do they migrate?
Well, the resident redfish, the juvenile redfish, do. They live in the marsh year round. They do not migrate. They live in the marsh, and there's some different opinions and arguments about, you know, at what age a redfish matures to leave the marsh, you know, to join the adult breeding population that's moved offshore. Some people say, well, it's 5 years, but, you know, they've found fish that they've recorded as 2 and 3 years old, you know, in these offshore populations. So I would say, you know, anywhere between 2 and 6 years, just depending on, you know, at what rate they mature. Until then, they're going to live in the marsh. And once they mature and are ready to move to that offshore population, become part of the breeding, spawning population, which they will live offshore for the rest of their life until the spawn, but until then, they're going to live in the marsh. And so once again, I guess you could say it could range anywhere from 2 to even 6 or 7 years of age that they'll live in that marsh, but probably average 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you say they move offshore. Are you saying
they do salt water, or?
They move
offshore. Into deeper water, out into the Gulf of Mexico here, and they will live offshore for the rest of their lives. That being said, every year for the rest of their life, they will come back to spawn in near shore waters a lot of times, or most of the time, that occurring near the passes, major passes, such as passes of the Mississippi River, or just along the coastline in areas where you have a lot of tidal movement, and typically areas of higher salinity, but areas where, you know, after laying those eggs, with a strong tidal movement, those eggs can be naturally, you know, just pushed up into the marsh with the tides.
Now, are you saying, when you're saying marsh, it's this brackish water? Or
when I refer to marsh, when we talk about fishing in the marsh, in the bayous, you know, however you want to refer to it, it's all brackish water. And typically, you know, within that brackish water, the further you get towards the Gulf of Mexico, the higher the salinity level. So even in the furthest inland coastal marshes that we'll launch into, it's going to be brackish, although there's certainly some freshwater marshes, but I'm referring to the coastal marshes. It's going to be brackish water, but once again, just as you get closer to the Gulf of Mexico, the salinity levels are going to increase, you know, all the way to the boat ramp, you know, in these coastal marshes, you're going to have a certain amount of salinity, and they're going to be redfish there.
Okay. where you fish for the redfish down there, how big do they get? What's a trophy fish in that area, and what's the average size fish?
Well, year round, when you're talking about the resident fish that are in the interior marshes in abundance year round, a great size fish is 10 pounds. That's a fantastic fish. Sometimes you'll catch those fish at 12 pounds, but on average, year-round, the fish that you're going to be targeting in the marsh, the average size is going to be somewhere between 4 and 6, 4 and 7 pounds, but with quite a few fish getting up there in that 8, 9, even 10-pound range, and sometimes, even higher. Now, when those bull reds, those mature bull reds, come back into the marsh, during the spawn, they get huge. The largest one caught on fly here in Louisiana in that shallow water was just over 41 pounds. The largest redfish caught in Louisiana all tackle is over 60 pounds. So they get very large. And I probably ought to clarify, when they come back in to spawn, they're not actually spawning in those shallow marsh areas. They're spawning a little bit more in deeper water, once again, in the passes or off the beaches, areas where you have a lot of tidal movement, once again. But a lot of those fish do inevitably find their way into the shallow water to feed, and that's when we get those unique and exciting opportunities to target those larger fish in very shallow water. And, although I try not to get people too hyped up to the point of where they expect to see those fish this time of year, it's not that uncommon.
But those flies you're giving away are guaranteed to catch 10 pounders, right?
Absolutely. Every time.
Yeah, okay.
Every time.
Well, let's talk, since you mentioned the spawn here, and we've got several questions about time of year. I've got Lee Robbins in Kodiak, Alaska. He says he's now leaving Alaska on a road trip. I hope he said it's south. But he says he's got his fly rod. And is there any red fishing to do this time of year? And then we've got a couple other questions. Don in Montana wants to know the best time of year. George in Texas, best time for sight casting. And then Alan Rupp in Beach Park, Illinois, near Chicago, wants to know if January is a good time to visit. So why don't you just cover all these guys' questions and talk about time of year and then, when that spawn is happening, if you wanted to come in for the big guys, how all that lays out?
Well, first of all, I can say with a very clear conscience that here in Louisiana, we absolutely have a year-round fishery. It is a legitimate 12-month fishery. You could go out any day during any given month and have your best day red fishing in terms of the number of fish you see, the number of shots you get. That being said, there are some changes at different times of year, some things that not necessarily to expect in terms of weather, but there are some changes, some seasonal changes throughout the year to take into account anyways. Right now, just to answer the first question for the gentleman who's coming from Alaska, this is a fantastic time of year to fish. In fact, if I was to ever move away from Louisiana and plan to come back for a fishing trip once a year, it would probably be in October or November, and really probably in November. It's a great time of year to fish. It's a very comfortable time of year here to fish. The redfish seem to be very active this time of year. Water levels are great. You get a lot of clean water. We don't have that many fronts pushing through like we will as we move a little bit further into winter. So I wouldn't ever want to say that it's predictably good weather this time of year, because certainly we have those unfishable days that come up this time of year as well. But overall, the weather's very nice this time of year. Most people would consider this, and people who live here would consider this kind of the peak redfish season, although once again there are opportunities year-round. It's a very nice time of year to fish here. And it is a time of year where, we are seeing a good number of those bigger fish in shallow water. Once again, I try not to get people too hyped up about that, because you just don't know on any given day out whether you're going to really get a shot at those big fish or not. But if that was your goal, if you wanted to come to Louisiana in search of those big, big bull red fish, you would probably plan your trip sometime between mid-October and February. But once again, the further you get into winter, the more chance you have of strong fronts pushing through, and really blowing things out for days at a time, churning up the water for days at a time. So right now is a really nice time of year to come down here and fish. We do have fronts to push through, but typically not as common as they will be a little bit, you know, later in the year or first part of next year. Once again, it's a comfortable time of year to fish. A lot of clean water this time of year. So fishing's great right now. The further you get into winter, you can also have some unbelievable days, but it's kind of hit or miss. If you plan a trip, let's say for January, some people might argue with me on this, but I'd say you got about a 50% chance at best of whether you're even going to get on the water or not, because it's very common that fronts will push through and just blow things out for days at a time. So it's kind of a crapshoot planning a trip in here in January or February, and that you're either not going to get on the water or you're going to get on the water, and it's probably going to be fantastic. So it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot in between. I think summertime's a great time of year to fish here, too. If you find areas where you have a lot of grass to really filter water, and at times during the summer, you know, you can find shallow water areas with a lot of grass that really filter that water that provide for some crystal clear water. And one thing I like about summer is that, although I don't want to say predictable, there's so many just slick, calm mornings, you know, in July and August, where you could see a redfish tail pop, you know, at 200 yards away. So you just get some super slick, calm mornings. You can almost guarantee that by the afternoon at some point in the summer there's going to be some kind of thunderstorm roll through. So if you plan to get on the water early and be off by early afternoon, chances are you're going to have a lot of great days to fish in the summer. So conditions do change, but once again, and I guess this could be said for so many other fisheries too, that, you know, so much depends on just the weather over a given few days versus what season you're in. But there are some somewhat predictable changes that occur with the seasons.
Well, as you well know, having fished up in Jackson and, you know, Montana and Wyoming area,
mm-hmm.
some of the best days there are September, October, but it could also snow on you. So,
absolutely. October seems like a nice time to be anywhere.
Yeah, it is. It is. It really is. Yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break here, Alec, but when we come back, we'll talk with you more about fishing for big redfish in the Louisiana bayous.
Great.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Alec Griffin about big redfish in the Louisiana bayous. If you'd like to ask Alec a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And I seriously encourage you to send those questions in. We've already got a few here that we're going to answer. Some of them I want to answer right, you know, ask Alec right away because they may fit in better later in the show, but we'll really try to get to all of them, and we enjoy that interaction. Well, before we go on here, Alec, why don't you tell us a bit about your business down in New Orleans?
Oh, well, thank you, Roger. We've got a great fly shop right downtown New Orleans. For anybody who's familiar with New Orleans, corner of Camp and Julia, 601 Julia Street, it's called Uptown Angler. We're really the only full-service fly shop in New Orleans. We carry all premium lines in rods, reels, have a great saltwater fly selection, all the apparel, all the goodies and gadgets and gifts you'd ever need. We do a fly fishing school. We book guided trips, and it's a great little fly shop. It's been around for 10 years, serving the people of New Orleans and all those coming to New Orleans to enjoy our fishery. Once again, it's Uptown Angler. For anybody that wants to learn more about us, they can go to our website, uptownangler.com, where you can find all kinds of information about the shop, about fish in the area, and, of course, contact information if anybody ever wants to contact me by way of telephone or email to chat more about the red fishing opportunities.
Well, great, great. Alec, if you're to fly into New Orleans, how soon could a guy be on the water? Are you close to the fisheries there?
You know, realistically, factoring traffic and everything else, about an hour and a half.
Okay.
The airports, it's going to take you about 20 to 30 minutes on any given day to get from the airport to the city itself. And from the city, you're looking at about, on average, an hour to get to the fishing. There's a couple spots that are a little less and some spots a little more. A lot of people know of Venice, Louisiana, kind of just a legendary fishing spot. That's a little bit further down. That's actually about 2 hours south of the city, so that's a little further. But within an hour from the city of New Orleans, you can be in the middle of some fantastic shallow water red fishing.
Great, great. With redfish, you know, we all have heard or have tasted black and redfish, and there's a couple of questions that relate to that. Are there are there slot limits down there? Are they all catch and release? And
Martin, they are.
They're what?
There are slot limits. There sure
are. Okay.
16 inches to 27 inches is a slot. And it's a limit of 5 redfish per day per angler. One of those fish can exceed 27 inches, and no redfish can be in possession in federal waters. So when you're offshore in those federal waters, which is a great thing because, you know, all of the fish that you would catch offshore typically are going to be those bull reds, those mature breeding stock. So you're taking fish out of that breeding population. So no redfish in possession in federal waters, but inshore state waters, 16 to 27 inches, 5 per angler, 1 over 27 inches allowed.
When you say federal waters, where is the break point to federal waters?
You know, I couldn't even tell you exactly. I don't do that much offshore fishing. So if you're fishing inshore and near shore, not something you're really going to have to worry about. If you do a fair amount of offshore fishing, if you would even consider yourself offshore, consider that redfish
federal, okay,
going back in the water. Better safe than sorry. And you know what? You know, those big fish that you're going to catch out there, there's no real reason to keep those anyway.
Yeah.
That's a picture fish. That's all those fish are. Fun to fight and make for a great picture. No reason to bring them home.
Well, as Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas wants to know, what's your favorite way to cook a redfish? Is blackened still the way to go?
Blackened's a great way to go, but you know what? There's not many bad ways to cook a redfish. The only way that I would say I don't want to cook a redfish is just overcooking. There's so many ways to cook it. I would have to say my personal favorite would simply be referred to as redfish on the half shell, and that's simply taking a fillet, but leaving the skin on, and grilling that fish flesh side down for a very brief period of time over an open flame, then turning over with the scales down on the grill, and I don't necessarily want to say slow cooking it, but cooking it for, you know, 5 to 10 minutes more, depending on the size of the fillet. And when it's when that fillet is done, you can take a spatula and scoop that fillet right off the skin, right off the grill, and leave the skin sitting on the grill. So it's a fantastic way to cook them. And just when it's fresh redfish, Roger, my opinion is really almost the less seasoning the better. It's just such a great, mild, flaky fish that is very light seasoning, and just a little squeeze of lemon or lime is going to be great. But the blacken is certainly a classic. Blackened redfish is certainly a classic New Orleans dish, and it is fantastic.
Yeah. I'm curious because, you know, for a while, and this was probably 20 years ago or so, you know, blackened redfish was a big kind of, it was kind of a fad, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And do they then commercially fish for those, or do they farm those, or how do the
restaurants? No, they used to commercially fish for those. It was, you know, it's kind of a funny thing, and won't necessarily get too deep into this, but not that long ago in Louisiana, redfish by most anglers were considered a trash fish. So not that many people were interested in them. Paul Prudhomme, and I can't give you the year, but Paul Prudhomme introduced black and redfish as a signature dish. Kind of turned into a craze. They really started heavily commercially harvesting those fish with the gill nets in the marsh. And that was before I ever moved to Louisiana, but the stories I've been told that it just nearly wiped out the redfish population, or at least significantly devastated that population. Thank goodness they banned those gill nets. The population rebounded dramatically, and now we have just a fantastic redfish population in our shallow water marshes with no gill nets, and they're no longer commercially harvested.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, that happens, doesn't it? That happens.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
We did get a question here on the Internet from Rod Brashears in Amarillo. He's going to be down in Lafayette for Thanksgiving, so obviously he's down there for a good time of year. Is there any good red fishing close to Lafayette?
Yeah, you know, there's good red fishing in the western part of the state as well. Lafayette, Lake Charles, which is not that far from Lafayette, there is good fishing over there. And, in fact, could certainly recommend a guide in that area to the gentleman who asked that question. If you ever want to contact me at the shop, because absolutely, there's some great, great red fishing opportunities over that way.
Okay, great, great. Rod also asked when the spawn takes place. I think you kind of identified that between November and February.
The actual spawn itself, according to the books, says that spawn really occurs during mid-August through mid-October. That's the spawn itself. But a lot of those fish, you know, sort of stick around for a while. Once again, certainly find their way into the shallow water to feed, once again, for even months. You can find those fish through February, sometime into early March. But the actual spawn itself, and once again, this is just according to what I've read, is from around mid-August through around mid-October.
Okay.
And maybe that would explain why around mid-October they start becoming more prevalent in the shallow water marsh at that time, because their spawn is completed.
Yeah.
Because they're not actually spawning in that shallow water marsh. So, you know, with the salt that their primary objective would be the spawn, you know, they would complete that and then end up finding their way into that shallow water.
Right.
So around mid-October through February primarily is when you could expect to really start seeing them, you know, in the shallow water marshes. And more so the closer to the Gulf, the closer to the passes that you get. The further inland, which you just consider the more interior marsh, the fewer those fish you could expect to see.
Let's talk a little bit more here, Alec, about the bayous, the marsh, the passes, as you described them, because there's a lot of us that aren't familiar with that kind of fishery, and I know it is quite unique, much different than Florida and the Keys and things like that. So kind of describe to us how that waterways work and you know, define what a pass is versus a marsh versus a bayou.
Well, I would simply say this. When you hear people refer to the marsh or coastal marsh, we'll just think about this as coastal marshes versus inland freshwater marshes. You know, the coastal marshes, basically, if you look at a map of Louisiana and, you know, for all practical purposes for where we are in New Orleans, southeast Louisiana, and you look at southeast Louisiana jutting out into the Gulf of Mexico and you've got a solid landmass, well, all of a sudden, it starts breaking up from being a solid landmass into series of waterways, but also land, broken marsh. And basically, the marsh is that buffer between the Gulf of Mexico and the solid landmass. And the marsh is really a series of all kinds of waterways, and sometimes you'll hear the same waterway referred to as a couple of different things, but just generally speaking, a series of, you know, some deeper bays, lots of shallow bays, you know, flats, small, even what people would refer to as marsh ponds, canals or bayous. A lot of sometimes one little waterway might be referred to as a canal. Somebody else might call it a bayou. But it's just the marsh is really just this maze, this series of bays, ponds, you know, canals, bayous. And then the passes, like passes off the Mississippi River, where the Mississippi River, you know, really breaks up into almost fingers as it goes into the Gulf of Mexico versus just one major waterway dumping directly into the Gulf of Mexico. So it's the river passes where it actually breaks out into, once again, I don't know any better way to refer it other than fingers to cut into the, or to dump into the Gulf of Mexico. But yeah, the marsh is just a, once again, a series of waterways and and broken land masses. I don't know if that answers the question well, but...
No, I think you're kind of describing that the passes are probably places with current, more moving water.
You're actually going to get current, you know, throughout the marsh. With the tide moving in and out, you'll get current throughout the marsh as a whole.
Yeah.
But the passes more so being the river passes, where once again the Mississippi River breaks up into a variety of big waterways that lead out into the Gulf of Mexico. But no, you'll get current throughout the marsh, you know, in the bays, in the waterways like canals or bayous, you know, all the way up into the small little shallow ponds. You'll certainly be affected by current, by tidal movement throughout the coastal marsh.
And in contrast, the coastline of Florida and so forth, you don't have the mangroves and so forth they have in Florida. You have these grassy areas or marshes, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you know what, Roger? I have heard of some mangroves at places in Louisiana, whether somebody's calling something a mangrove that's actually not a mangrove, or whether there actually are a few mangroves in places. It's certainly, I've never seen what I would consider mangroves, more as opposed to just, you know, small land masses, grassy areas. Definitely different from what I would consider, you know, mangroves that you see people fishing in Florida and the Caribbean.
We've got some questions here, too. Bernard in Santa Monica, California. And this is a question we all want to know, I think, is have the fisheries been affected by Katrina or any of the subsequent hurricanes that have come through there? How did that affect the fisheries?
Well, I would say they've absolutely been affected. Not necessarily in terms of short-term quality in the sense that, you know, you could have gone out in the marshes in September or October of 05, shortly after Katrina, and had some fantastic fishing days. So the fishing quality is still high. You know, the fish themselves tend to rebound well, but the real devastating aspect of it is the loss of habitat, the loss of marsh. Even without those major storms, the state of Louisiana is experiencing just massive land loss in the marsh due to coastal erosion, which really stems from a variety of causes, a variety of factors. But nonetheless, annually we're losing a tremendous amount of marsh, on average at this point about 25 to 35 square miles a year. And those major storms are really just a catalyst to that. To give you an example, just during Katrina and Rita, during those two storms, the state of Louisiana lost over 200 square miles of marsh. It turned where there were 200 square miles of marsh is now open water just from those two storms. So, you know, the loss of habitat during these major storms is massive. So, yes, I would say it affects the fisheries in terms of, you know, the fishing opportunities because, you know, the more open water you have, you know, especially in small boats, you know, in a sense, the less water you can access or access safely, you know, the less protected water you have. You know, I would say the fish are doing just fine, but it is a loss of habitat, you know, in the sense of, you know, how much protected water there is to get out there and fish. And the storms, once again, do major damage, but even without those major storms, just the coastal erosion that we're experiencing now on a daily basis is phenomenal. It's just, it's really scary.
It's
to the point
and
where
it probably takes years. Takes years for that to rebuild because that's the delta that is sediment deposits and that doesn't happen quickly.
Well, and you know, this, I tell you what, that could be a whole another hour and a half and then a whole another hour and a half. There's a lot of different opinions about that in terms of what's happening, what's the possible solution. But the fact is it's a major, major issue here that everybody's extremely concerned about, you know, just an exponential loss of land, of marshland each year. Just to give you an example, I mean, Louisiana, the state of Louisiana, accounts for 30% of the nation's, you know, shallow water marsh, but accounts for 90% of the coastal marsh lost every year. In the lower 48 states. So it's a massive problem, and with that loss of land, that marsh being the sort of first line of defense, that buffer to knock down storm surge, and the more that marsh that gets taken away, the stronger that surge is, the further in it comes, and it's just this snowball effect, you know, where each major storm, you know, the impacts seem to worsen significantly. So it's a major issue, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
But yeah, I was going to, there was a question here from Joanne in San Luis Obispo, California. I guess she's fished out there before, and she wants to know what areas were lost as a result of the storm. She said a lot was, she said she normally fishes out of Venice and Cocodri. I don't know if I said that
Cocodri.
Right. Cocodri. Cocodri. In the past, wants to set up a trip for this spring, and I guess she's wondering if those areas are still fishing areas.
Absolutely. I mean, those places are still intact. However, just like anywhere else along the Louisiana coastline, there's just less marsh every year. Those are still, you know, those are still access points to the marsh that the major fishing grounds, very productive fisheries, Venice and Cocodri. They're alive and well in the sense that the marinas are still there, guides are still operating out of there, the fishing is still fantastic. Just less habitat, less protected water.
We need to take a quick break here, Alec, and when we come back, we'll talk more about hooking up with those big redfish. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkoff. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. To learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net, womensflyfishing.net, or you can call them at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Alec Griffin about big redfish in the Louisiana bayous. If you'd like to ask Alec a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. Another question here is Hal, and he's from New Orleans. He's one of your neighbors down there. And this kind of coincides, I think, with maybe the loss of habitat and other things. But he wants to know what the current trend in Louisiana fly fishing is. You know, is there growth? Is it from locals or out-of-towners? We know Louisiana, here's what his words, we know Louisiana has beyond world-class fishing, but our culture seems to promote meat fishing. Should we keep it as the best-kept secret in the U.S.? So can you kind of address his question?
Absolutely. The first thing I would say is, as far as should we keep it the best-kept fishing secret, I think it's too late for that. I think the secret's out. I think over the last few years, you know, we've seen a tremendous amount of publicity for the state of Louisiana as a fly fishing destination in, you know, major fly fishing publications, in videos, in TV shows. There's been a lot of, you know, a lot of press for Louisiana fly fishing over the last few years. I think that's due to a variety of things, but you know, the current trend is, I would say, you know, it's on the rise in interest. We'll see what the stock market does. The local or the more recent activity in the stock market certainly hadn't been a catalyst to leisure product purchases and endeavors. But no, I think even with that, we're seeing fly fishing on the rise in Louisiana, both in the local fishing community and out-of-towners. And I think part of the reason for the local fly fishing community taking more interest is because they're seeing so much interest, so many people coming from out of state to do this. They're seeing it in the magazines. They're seeing it on the TV shows. So inevitably, they're just hearing more and more about it, and it becomes, you know, hey, I got to try this kind of thing. Not everybody wants to try it. And, you know, I would agree with Hal, and it was something that I certainly noticed, you know, when I moved down here. And I'm not saying that it's right or wrong or one thing's better than the other, but, you know, coming from a trout town like Jackson Hole where it seems like every other person's a fly fishing guide, you know, and there's such a strong catch and release ethic, once again, right or wrong, you know, it was definitely something I noticed when I moved down here, you know, whether you want to call it a meat mentality or just, you know, the fact that people were raised, you know, harvesting fish, bringing those fish home and cooking them. that's definitely very common for most fishermen here to bring fish home. And at times you'll even hear people refer to the success of their day by, what time they got off the water, how early they got off the water with their limits versus how long, what a great, beautiful, full day they got to spend out on the water.
Yeah.
Once again, that's not everybody, though. We've got a lot of great conservation-minded sportsmen down here in Louisiana. I think a lot of people, and something that I've certainly tried to dispel, through the shop and through instruction is, the myth that A, fly fishing is rocket science, that it's so difficult, and B, that it has to be extremely expensive, neither of which is true. As probably most people listening to this broadcast know, it's not rocket science. It requires a little time and practice, and proper instruction helps, and that you don't have to spend your life savings for a high-performance startup combo.
Right.
I think that's part of the reason for the rise in interest is that now, and maybe this is here and everywhere else, is that you can get really high-performance tackle for significantly less cost these days. But I also think it's just the fact that, once again, everybody who's from here was just seems like everybody fishes. Everybody has grown up fishing. And, most people who live here and fish over the course of their life, they've caught thousands of redfish, thousands of speckled trout, and, fly fishing just offers them a new, fun, exciting way to target those fish. And in my opinion, in that shallow water, in those sight fishing situations, with a fly rod's potentially your best tool for the job. So, in short, I think it's on the rise. I think we're seeing more and more interest, and I think we're seeing more people come here to do this.
Well, since you mentioned speckled trout, Rod Brashears in Amarillo, Texas, again, wants to know what other species you can catch when fishing for reds. Is speckled trout one of them, or is that a totally
different? Speckled trout is one of them. There's plenty of speckled trout in the marsh, sometimes a year more than others. Summertime, like May, June, July, typically being the most popular time of year to fish for specks, in the coastal marshes, although there's certainly places and ways to catch them at other times of year, but that May, June, July really sort of being that hot trout season. And typically, on a day out for redfishing, though, when you're talking about targeting those fish on fly, the goal of most fly anglers is to sight fish with good reason. That's where that fly rod is most effective versus covering water, especially covering deeper water. And when you're up on those marsh flats, that we're fishing on a regular basis, most of the time, or a lot of the time, we're fishing in 6, 8, 10 inches, sometimes a foot of water, and certainly sometimes a little bit deeper. But, when looking for those sight fishing situations, we're fishing really shallow water, and typically you're not going to find those speckled trout in that really shallow water. It doesn't mean that they're not a rock's throw away, in some deeper water, and maybe a deeper, bayou or canal or even just a deeper bay that's not so far off, but you're not going to find them, up on those really shallow flats. So when you are out there, and you're targeting, you're trying for those shallow water sight fishing opportunities, you're not going to be throwing at specks in that shallow water. You're going to have to go a little bit deeper. But there are other fish to throw at, black drum, sheephead, alligator gar, sometimes jack crevalle. But once again, redfish definitely being the predominant target.
Right, right. There was a question on the Internet that came in, Jack Mullins in Greenville, Texas. He says, since you just mentioned, the shallow water flats, he says, do you just fish the flats for them, or do you sometimes go out into deeper water?
Well, you certainly can go into deeper water, and there's certainly redfish there. But I guess my opinion about that, when at least speaking about fly fishing and targeting these fish with a fly rod, just no reason to. Plenty of fish in shallow water. Plenty of fish in shallow water year-round.
Okay. Another couple questions. Greg Martin in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas, both asking about your rod and reel setup. So could you talk about the size, weight rod you use, and anything specific about reels, too?
Absolutely. There are situations here where you could really, for redfish, where you could justify fishing anything from a 6-weight to a 10-weight. When I talk about fishing a 6-weight for redfish, I want it to be a really stout saltwater 6 with a good solid butt for fighting fish. And that's a lot of fun during the summertime when the chances of running into really big fish like these bull reds that we've spoken of is very unlikely. That six weight is a good solid stout six weight. It's going to be really fun, but also effective tool for fishing for those summertime redfish when you're fishing the resident redfish, typically not exceeding 8, 9, or 10 pounds, more commonly a little smaller than that. And when you're fishing those really slick, calm summer mornings that I spoke of, it sure is nice laying a six-weight line down over that water, versus an 8 or a 9. Although, if you were to have one redfish rod for Louisiana, I would say it would be an 8-weight. That's my opinion, but I think that's going to be your most versatile rod here. I don't think there's a whole lot that you can't do in shore Louisiana with an 8-weight. The situations where 10-weight would be totally justified this time of year, when especially if you're fishing those outer edges of the marsh, closer to the Gulf, closer to those passes where your chances of seeing those big bull redfish are more likely, a 10-weight is certainly not overgunning for those fish. So situations where you can fish anything from a 6 through a 10 in terms of reels, it can be pretty simple here. You're not talking about fish typically that are going to take, 100, 200-yard blistering runs that are going to burn up drag systems. They're very strong fish, and they fight hard. But typically, it's just a really good tugging match, within a relatively short distance of the boat. So you don't have to necessarily have a super sophisticated drag, but I think you do want certain features on a reel, certainly bar stock aluminum for durability versus cast. You want it to be anodized to help avoid the corrosion in salt water. Something with a good, smooth, reliable drag system, is a good thing. Large arbor, is great, not necessary, but it's a nice thing to have. And, one thing that I really look for in a reel is somewhat simplicity, in the internals, something that can be cleaned very easy. Although we fish a lot of clean water here, you're still talking about being out in the marsh, where there is mud, whether it's, getting on or off the boat at the ramp or what have you. There's good chances that at times you could get some mud on your reel, or certainly like any saltwater environment, some salt water in the internals and something that's really easy to clean, really easy to see if it's dirty. That's great, but you can keep it pretty simple.
Okay. And then what about the type of line that you use?
I think the most important thing is to have a line that's going to load up a rod quick. I mean, so many of the shots that we're getting at these fish on the flats, you're talking, 40, 30, 20, sometimes even 10 or less feet away. I mean, sometimes you will catch these fish right next to the boat. It doesn't mean that you never have to make a slightly longer cast to get to the fish, but typically we're making pretty short casts, but those short casts have to count. You want to be on target with them. So you don't want a line that requires you to have, 30, 40 feet out of the rod tip before you really start getting into the belly and loading that rod up. You want a line that's going to load up a rod quick. I mean, just to throw out a few that I like to fish that I think are very effective tapers for here, the Royal Wolf Bermuda Triangle, or even the Royal Wolf Bass Taper, the Teeny Flip Pallet Series, and really probably my favorite line that I think's really the most versatile for fishing here is the Scientific Angler Mastery Redfish. It's a line I'm comfortable fishing year-round, loads up a rod real quick. Always, I think it's important to say, always in the shallow water marsh, we're fishing floating lines. I guess if you want to fish deeper, deeper holes, some canals, you certainly could fish a sinking line, but I don't own a sinking line right now to fish in Louisiana with. It's all floating lines, and just keep in mind that, 9, 10 months out of the year here, you're fishing more or less tropical conditions. So a soft four line, especially a line you might use in cold water up in Alaska or wherever else, you try to fish that in warmer months here, and you're going to be sacrificing performance.
Yeah. Well, and that's what you're down there for, is to do that sight fishing. I mean, that's the excitement of fishing in the shallows.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And leaders, and just a note on leaders, I don't fish anything less than 16-pound test. And you can fish pretty short. I'd rather fish a 7.5 foot than a 9 foot. Fluorocarbon's just fine. If you're going to fish mono, try to pick a good abrasion-resistant mono. But I personally, I don't fish anything less than 16-pound test.
And that's just a non-tapered leader or just a...
Oh, no, no, definitely tapered. Definitely tapered.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. George had asked about that in Texas, George in Texas. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's George Bush or not, but he's from Texas and his name's George. Anyway, he also asked about, he may be very mad at me for associating him with that, but if you, he wants to know if you use spoon flies.
Absolutely.
And if so, what knot do you normally use to tie fly to leader?
Absolutely. Spoon flies are very effective down here. I find them to be most effective in the summertime, you know, times of year when you have a lot of grass that you're fishing in. There's a local guide here named Rich Waldner who ties a very special spoon. It's called Waldner Spoon Fly. It's the most weedless fly I've ever fished here in the marsh. Redfish will absolutely pounce on it. You can fish it right in the grass, you know, with very little frustration. So, yes, I absolutely fish spoon flies.
What
and I
is
use
a okay, first, sorry? Before you go further, what is a spoon fly?
Well, if you picture a gold spoon, a conventional gold or silver spoon, a Johnson Silver Minnow or, you know, any other kind of spoon, just that shape, that typical shape, which allows it to wobble and put off a vibration, it's basically a fly version of that. I've seen them tied in a variety of different ways, the original spoon fly certainly being Kay's Wobbler, you know, from John Cave in Florida, you know, and everything else was, in my opinion, built off that concept. I've seen them done out of all kinds of materials, everything from fake fingernails to mylar to the one that this gentleman I spoke about, Captain Rich Waldner, does that out of a combination of copper wire, epoxy, glitter, paint, monofilament. So there's a variety of things that go into it, and they can be tied out of any variety of materials. The idea being that it's that spoon shape to a degree that's gonna allow it to wobble in the water, put off some vibration, put off a little extra flash. And I'll say this, just a quick note, and this is just opinion. You know, I've had people come in the shop and start talking about spoon flies not being flies, and you know what? If somebody doesn't want to fish a spoon, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But, you know, when you ask somebody typically why they wouldn't fish a spoon, you're going to get some kind of response of it, you know, breaks tradition, you know, doesn't use natural fibers. I mean, you're going to find that same angler most of the time, you know, fishing a 70 million modulus graphite rod. So,
yeah.
You know.
A lure is a lure.
Fish what makes you happy. You know, fish what makes you happy. I'm not going to criticize anybody for not fishing a spoon as long as they're not going to criticize somebody for fishing a spoon. You know, you look at most flies these days, at least most saltwater flies, and you're going to find more synthetic fibers than natural fibers on almost any of them.
I can't remember the name of the fly, but Pete Parker tied a fly with a propeller on the front, a little propeller.
Coyote? I've seen some of those.
That was quite controversial.
In my opinion, you know, this is all about having fun. You know, if that's fun to you to fish that fly or any other fly, whether somebody else might call it a fly or not, have at it.
We need to take a break here again, but he did ask about the knots you use to tie on spoon flies or something.
I use a non-slip loop knot. Yeah, and that loop knot just allows that fly to move a little more freely.
Okay. All right, well, we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about redfish. Flats Time Charters is your sponsor for this segment of the show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish with big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as the seasonal snooker tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and this shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to this website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Alec Griffin about big redfish in the Louisiana bayous. If you'd like to ask Alec a question, just go to our homepage
and submit your question using that text box, and we'll receive it immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. Okay, we're doing pretty good here, Alec, moving through our questions here. Let's talk about flies, more about flies, since we already started out with spoon flies. Let's talk about food source first, actually. What's the primary food source for the redfish in the bio area there?
I would say there's nothing that a redfish would rather eat, you know, on any given day than a blue crab. A lot of crabs out there. Redfish love to eat crabs. They'll certainly also eat shrimp, brown shrimp, white shrimp, and a variety of bait fish. Mullet, pogies, also referred to as menhaden. So, you know, they'll eat shrimp, crabs, bait fish, but I would say crabs, you know, probably being their favorite meal.
So what flies, Hank in New York wants to know, you know, what flies are used to simulate those?
Well, there's a lot of great crabs out there. Some of the crabs that I really like that I found to be extremely productive on a regular basis, almost any Enrico Puglisi crab. I'm a huge fan of Enrico's crabs, and there's a variety of them that I really like. The three-tone crab from Enrico is fantastic, and he's got a series of crabs called the Redfish Specials. I think those are all fantastic. Personally, I like the root beer color. But there's a lot of other great crabs out there. There's a crab that's an Umpqua pattern, and I apologize, I don't remember the tire's name who originated it, but it's the Kung Fu crab that's fantastic. There's a lot of great crabs. And, you know, you could probably fish a Delmarcan or, you know, any variety of other crabs. And if you put it in the right place, if you put it down in front of that fish and make it look like it's trying to get away, he's probably going to eat it. So I'd say the best crab is the one that's in front of him. But some of those Enrico crabs I really like a lot. And I like them because they're easy to get in front of the fish. They're very weedless. They sink fast. So it's just a very effective fly to fish, especially at close range.
Stan Stoneman in Houston, Texas, asks, what fly do you use most of the time? Shrimp, Del Brown crab. Let me make that more specific. What's your go-to fly? If you're going to take one fly, only one fly, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one because it's just going to be so dependent. It's going to be so dependent upon conditions.
Okay.
You know, I'm not going to fish a crab unless I'm sight fishing. Typically that's going to be the goal. That's what we want to do. But if you find yourself in slightly deeper water or a little more off-color water where the primary objective becomes, you know, to cover as much water as possible in places that you think fish are going to hold, you know, a crab's just not the fly to do that with. You know, you're not just going to strip a crab through the water covering a lot of water with it. You know, for that, you're going to choose something, either a shrimp or some kind of bait fish pattern or a spoon. That's an example of where a spoon fly would be effective. If you're just covering water, just trying to find fish, you know, because the spoon's going to put off that vibration, you know, you could be behind a fish, and that vibration caused him to turn around and see what's going on back there and possibly find your fly. Whereas, you know, if you were stripping a clouser or something, you know, a little sleeker fly that's not going to be displacing water, you could strip it right behind him and he'd never know it was there. So, you know, it just depends on whether I think you're going to be covering water, you know, with whether you want to call it blind casting or whatever else. A guy down here refers to it as predictable area casting. If you're going to be doing that,
that's pretty
you're probably going to choose something other than a crab fly. But if you're going to be sight fishing in a situation, especially where you're not necessarily having a whole lot of grass to deal with, a crab is going to be my top choice. But you know what? I'm a big fan of flies that I'll just call critter flies, flies that could really be taken, you know, by the redfish as any number of different bait sources depending on how it's fished. An example of that would be Dorsey's quan fly. You know, that's a fly that got a long enough profile to it that if you're stripping it through the water, you could very well have a fish pick that up like it's a shrimp or a fleeing bait fish. But the main body of it is just round enough and even has, you know, a little orange tuft, you know, like an egg sac on a crab that If you've got a fish that's actively feeding on crabs, and you drop that fly right in front of him and fish it like you're going to fish a crab, he'll probably suck it up like a crab. So, you know, a fly that could really represent any number of different food sources is going to be great. Once again, Dorsey's Swan, I think, is a great example of that.
Okay. James Page in Atlanta, this question came in on the Internet. Do you find fly fishing more challenging in Louisiana because of the tremendous amount of bait in the area? Referring to competition of live bait in the water.
Oh, from other anglers, or from
no,
the actual
no, I think
bait,
just
the actual
just,
bait in the water.
Yeah, the actual natural.
At times, yes. You know, if for no other reason, then sometimes it's hard to differentiate whether you're seeing a redfish in the water or a mullet tail. Today's a prime example. We had a great day of fishing today and caught quite a few fish, but you know, at times we were in areas where there were a lot of mullet, and the water was, you know, at times in places just off color enough, you know, where we're really at least at first looking for shadows, and, you know, you're getting excited about mullet, you're getting excited about stingrays, you know, you're getting excited about crabs, even oyster shells at a distance, and then you realize what they are. So I would say, at times, it makes it more difficult just to differentiate what's a redfish versus what's mullet or what's something else. But and there are times, certainly, you know, when you've got fish that are feeding on schools of bait, where yeah, it's kind of a crapshoot at times throwing your fly in there. It's kind of like for anybody who's ever fished any of those blanket hatches on the Henry's Fork.
Right.
You know, the idea of trying to throw out an imitation of what's hatching and hoping that one of those fish eats your fly versus the thousands of naturals that are on the water, it's kind of a crapshoot. So,
yeah. Okay, we've got a couple other questions here. Any particular colors that work best for redfish flies?
Absolutely. And this will be opinion, but it's an opinion shared by quite a few people, although there certainly be some arguments, but I would say, on average, and I think this is almost universal, chartreuse is a great color. And I think one of the reasons it's a great color is it just shows up so well even in off-colored water, which we do have at times. So chartreuse is a great color. Anything in the copper, root beer, gold family I think is great. Purple is a great color down here. And, you know, and then at times black. But I would say, you know, some colors, a few colors that are just dominant colors, purple, chartreuse, and then once again, anything in that root beer, bronze, copper family.
Right. Don in Destin, Florida wants to know, have you ever used topwater, poppers, gurgler-type patterns for redfish?
Absolutely. And that can be a lot of fun. When I typically like to fish poppers more than other times, you know, are those summer mornings out on the marsh, times when it makes perfect sense to be out there right at sunup because you know those fish are already going to be out on the flats, actively feeding. You know, a lot of times that until that sun gets up overhead, it can be a little more difficult to see them. But, you know you're throwing over grass flats, and a popper, in my opinion, is just a really fun way to cover that water before that sun really gets up to see those fish. Even when you can start seeing them, they will certainly take a topwater. Not every day. It would never be your go-to fly if your goal was to catch as many fish as possible on a given day. But there are certainly times when you can get redfish actively eating poppers. And, you know, it's a really fun way to catch them because they're really not designed to feed off the top of the water like that. They're designed to feed off the bottom. You know, their mouths are more or less on the bottom.
Like a bonefish,
So they got to, you know, they've got to bring their whole head out of the water almost to eat that popper. So it's a lot of fun. It's really exciting when you do get those fish taking poppers.
Well, let's talk a little bit about strategies and presentation techniques here in our final minutes here. First of all, there was a couple of questions. Larry in Missouri asking about types of boats. In other words, you've got your flats boats, canoes, kayaks. Is it practical to go out there in a kayak or a canoe?
Absolutely. Certainly, you're limited in range. You know, if all of a sudden you realize you're in an area where there's just not that many fish, you're limited as to how far you can go. But you know, in so many access points to the marsh here, you're in a very short paddle in some really productive water. So, in fact, I don't know exactly how you'd quantify this, but I would say, just as a guesstimate, that probably 80% or more of the recreational fly fishermen or fly fishers in Louisiana are fishing out of some kind of paddle craft. So it's a very effective way to fish the marsh.
Are you at a disadvantage because of your angle of view into the water?
I would say for seeing the fish, you know, when they're not tailing, or what we call crawlers, when they're just in such shallow water that their whole back's out of the water, yes, you are at a disadvantage in terms of seeing them. You know, but from stealth perspective, you know, you can get, not that you can't get close to the fish with a flat skiff either, but, you know, it's such a quiet, stealthy way to approach these fish, you know, that it can be very effective. And, you know, the way they're making some of these kayaks and canoes now that are perfectly stable to stand in, you know, there's still some really good sight fishing opportunities for those paddle craft as well. So, yeah, very effective way.
Okay, Mike Swainer in Springdale, Arkansas, wants to know where the best times to hunt redfish in Louisiana. Now, we've already talked about times of year, so whether he meant this or not, let's talk about times of day here. Is a better time of day to go after the redfish?
I would say any day you've got a favorable marine forecast. If you've got a day where you've got low winds, you know, good sunshine, and decent tidal movement, and your wife lets you go, get on the water. You know, if you polled 100 Louisiana anglers of whether they'd rather fish a falling tide or an incoming tide, you know, 95 of them are going to tell you they'd rather fish a falling tide. Yeah, I tend to agree with that, but I would say simply you want some tidal movement. When you don't have much tidal movement, you know, during a slack tide, you know, or even at that transition period, you know, when that tide's changing, those tend to be, I hesitate to call them dead times, but the activity definitely seems to, you know, to decrease during those slack tides. So I would say definitely, you know, look at tides. If you can get out there on a good falling tide and you've got a good marine forecast, you know, have at it. But I would also say in terms of times of day, summertime makes perfect sense to get out there bright and early when that sun's coming up. Those fish are already going to be up on that, up on those shallow flats feeding. Colder winter days, you know, it might make sense to wait till that sun gets up, starts warming up those flats a little bit before those fish are really going to get up in that shallow water, you know, actively feeding.
Okay. A couple questions here. Damon in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and another one here. How do you find the good fishing spots, and what's the best type of water to look for when you're looking for those spots?
Well, I'd say the best way to find the good fishing spots is to go with a good guide. and that's what I've done the bulk of the time that I've lived here. I've been fortunate enough to, you know, become good friends and work closely with the guides down here. And I tell you what, we've just got some fantastic guides. So the best way to experience the fishery is to go with one of these professional guides that's out there every day. But in terms of what I do on my own to try to find good spots, you know, I just look at the conditions during a given day. I look at the tide. I look what direction the wind's coming from, how strong the wind is. And, you know, looking at a chart, basically, you know, I make some judgment calls on not only where I think it's going to be, you know, some productive water to fish in terms of, you know, a good number of lee shorelines that are, you know, calmer shorelines to where seeing those fish is going to be a little easier. But also, you know, even more so, potentially from a safety standpoint, in terms of what areas you might have to cross more open water. And, you know, during a given wind direction, if it's strong enough, it might be really dangerous to cross a piece of open water in those small boats. Whereas if you had, you know, a lighter wind or from a different direction, it might be just fine. So safety plays a big role in how I decide where I'm going to go fishing. But after the safety, it's trying to pick a spot, you know, once again, where I think I'm going to have a lot of good protected shorelines, and then just get out and explore and try to find that water that's going to be shallow and, you know, whether it's got grass or oysters, you know, something on the bottom that's going to provide for a good habitat or a good place for redfish to feed. But absolutely making sure that you plan a route to get to where you're going that's going to be a safe route, you know, under the given conditions.
Does clarity of water impact the redfish behavior, eating, so forth?
I would say absolutely. I can't say from personal experience in the sense that when it's muddy, don't see how they're behaving.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But you know, they definitely feed a lot of times, you know, feed visually. I think it just goes without saying. In cleaner water, you know, they're going to see your fly or see that bait, that natural bait, at a greater distance versus it having to be right in front of them. So I would definitely say they're going to actively feed and look more for that cleaner water to feed in.
Right.
So absolutely, I would say you'll definitely have fish that are more active in that cleaner water, without a doubt. But I would also say this, you know, when you're in, you know, just crystal clear water, especially crystal clear water that's very calm and with a lot of sun, you know, that also can at times make those fish seem a little more wary, a little more spooky. So there's some give and take, but absolutely water clarity, I think, plays a role in how they feed, and they are looking for cleaner water to feed in.
But basically, you're looking for the kind of conditions that you look for, sight fishing for bonefish. I mean, low wind, right?
Good, absolutely.
Good light into the water.
Absolutely.
Protected areas and so forth, yeah.
And you know, in those conditions, these redfish, when you get clean water that's relatively calm and you get some good sunshine on that water, I mean, that bronze back, that copper bronze back, it just lights up out there. You know, I've heard somebody refer to it as lighting up like a neon Budweiser sign. And, uh-huh. You know, to a degree, I think that's a great comparison. Under the right conditions, you know, that bronze back just really lights up under the sun.
Now, Alec, we have only a minute or two left here, but I do want you to, so I'm just going to give you a free rein here to talk for those couple of minutes about once you spot that tailing redfish, that bronze back, what are your presentation techniques and what are your retrieval techniques? And I know this is asking a lot in the last few minutes, but do your best here to tell us how you
approach.
Absolutely.
And I would say, you know, getting comfortable with the techniques here is the hardest thing for anglers, no matter where they fished before or how good a caster they are. First of all, throw all notions of delicacy aside. When you see a redfish cruising here, put that fly in front of him. Put it in front of him fast. And do not lead that fish like you're trying to lead a bonefish. Don't put that fly 6 feet in front of him. Put it a foot or less in front of him. I mean, put it on his nose, and that's a hard thing for people to get comfortable with. That doesn't mean you're never going to spook fish, but you're going to catch a whole lot more fish, you know, practicing that type of presentation than trying to throw out a delicate cast or lead him by, 6, 8 feet. So get aggressive with it. Put that fly right on him, especially if he's tailing. If he's tailing, don't think about leading him at all. If he's tailing, put it right on his nose. If he's cruising, put it directly in front of him, and do not hesitate that if that cast is not where you want it, pick it back up and throw it again. Even if you think he's spooked, throw it again until you can't see that fish. He is catchable, I promise. Even if you've hooked him and he's thrown the hook, throw back on him. I've seen these fish hooked. Literally, I've seen these fish hooked and fought 3 and 4 times, spitting the hook and the throw back on them. Hook them again. Fight them. They throw the hook. Throw back on them. Hook them again. So never give up on catching these fish until you just can't see them anymore. As long as you can see them, they are catchable. You just got to be aggressive about it. You know, in terms of your strip, I would say just as a general statement, you know, longer, slower strips tend to be better. But, you know, really, you're hoping to sight fish. And when you're sight fishing, you're hoping to put that fly right in front of them. And when you put that fly right in front of him, you're hoping for him to see it. And typically when he commits to eating it, he's going to eat it. I think the key is really just keep it moving. And slow enough, just slow enough to where you're not pulling it out of the water, but just keep it moving away from him. You know, longer, slower strips probably being more effective. But once again, just do not give up on those fish. Continue to cast until you can't see them. Be aggressive with it. You know, in terms of technique for casting, you definitely angle your back cast in an upward direction because you're throwing down on these fish usually versus out at these fish. Just angle your back cast up accordingly so you can, you know, get a nice tight loop even when you're only talking about throwing 20 feet. So, you know, play with the angles of your cast, you know, do some target practice, things of that nature. But once again, don't worry about spooking the fish. And, yes, you will spook some, but I would much rather spook a fish because I threw it too close than have a fish never knew I was there because threw my fly too far away. You know, for the golfers out there, that's like short putting. You never gave it a chance. So,
that's a good note to end it on. So, unfortunately, Alec, it's time to wrap things up here. So, but that's a good note to end on. And when we return here, we're going to be giving away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, that 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion, and, of course, that dozen of Alec's favorite redfish flies. So stay tuned to see if you win. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family with and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage just below Alec's section there that says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for our drawing are randomly selected from our show's registration database. So if you didn't register online yet, it's a little late, but do so for our next show so that you can participate in a lot of the great gifts we have to give away. So the first thing we're going to give away is a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And you can learn more about the FFF if you go to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Great organization to support and participate in. So let's see who our winner for that 3-year membership is going to be. And that is going to be Tim Bauer in Illinois. It's Tim Bauer in Illinois. So congratulations, Tim, on that 3-year membership. I know you'll enjoy it. If you already have one, well, we'll get it extended for you. Now, our subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and if you want to learn more about Fly Fusion Magazine, you can go to www.flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Great magazine, a lot of how-to articles, and great photography out of Calgary, Canada. But now I think they've got a bigger subscription base in the U.S., so check it out. And the winner for that subscription is going to be Brian Larrington. Brian Larrington in Wisconsin. Again, congratulations, Brian, on that subscription, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. And also we have the Dozen Flies that is giving away courtesy Alec's Favorite Flies. Compliments of Uptown Angler in New Orleans, Louisiana, and their website is www.uptownangler.com, www.uptownangler.com. So, Alec, let's give away that dozen flies here. And, again, to win this, you need to go to our homepage, and there's that text box there where you could ask questions. And you've got to type in the answer to this question, plus your name and your location. So I hope you're all ready to go and ready to type. And the question is, what in Louisiana now, may not be this every place, but in Louisiana, what's the redfish's favorite food? What's the redfish's favorite food in Louisiana, as Alec talked about it earlier tonight? So the first person to send the correct answer in will win Alec's dozen favorite redfish flies. So, Alec, I'm checking the internet here, and I'm waiting for somebody to submit an answer. There we go. We get an answer, and it's Rod Brashears in Amarillo, Texas. He answers crab. Is he right, Alec? Alec? I guess we lost Alec. Well, Rod, I'll have to stand in for Alec, but I think you've got it there. It's the crab, so you've won the dozen flies from Uptown Angler. So, Rod, send me your email address so that, or send me your mailing address to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, or just submit that same information in the text box, and I can get it either way. and we'll get those flies out to you. Well, I want to thank Alec for being with us tonight. It was a great pleasure to talk with Alec, and hopefully we talk with him again sometime. We must have lost him off the call there at the last minute, but I think we had a great show, and he offered a lot of great information that we can all use. Our next broadcast will be on November 19th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And that show will be interviewing Chad Scheel, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing, the art of war. Well, Chad Scheel treats his fishing with all seriousness of going to war. He uses the term WET, or WET, to describe his approach, which stands for Weather Enemy Terrain, and is actually a military intelligence term used in the Marines to collect and evaluate intelligence to prepare battlefield operations. To find out how he applies this to your fly fishing, you'll have to listen in on our next show. So see you there. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115 extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.